I am Jen Wilson, author and body, mind and soul coach. Welcome to the I Am podcast, where we explore who you are. Hello, it's Jen from I Am Jen Wilson podcast and iamjenwilson.com. Today's guest is Mark from the Royston Youth Action. So I have been up there a few times teaching yoga, not recently because of COVID, hoping to get back sometime soon to finish our block. I had put a post out on my social media asking for people that could be guests on, and Sharon, that he works with, very kindly put his name forward and said that he had a great story and great information and great insight in the world. And holy fuck, yeah, this is one to listen to. So in today's show, we are talking about the work that Royston Youth Action does. We are talking about not liking school and choosing the path that you choose and changing career and Suicide Awareness Month. And we talk about Mark's own personal story about mental health and his experience with suicide. We talk about the youth of today and how they are maybe misrepresented in the press and how they can do better, and also that your postcode doesn't define who you are. So this show is amazing. Mark is an incredible human being, and I was honoured to get to have that conversation with him. So tune in, and as always, like it, share it. There will be somebody that you think of when you hear this, so please send them the podcast, get them to listen in to what Mark has to say, and be kind to each other, which is like the underlying message, ethos of today's podcast. And remember, head over to wherever you listen to your podcasts. If it allows you to write a review. And subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. All right, check it out. So welcome to another episode of the I Am Jen Wilson podcast. I am very pleased today to have, I'm going to get this right, Mark Nikowski.
Well done.
Right.
Yes.
Forgotten even from that quick chat before, like my brain just, other languages my brain really struggles with.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. So I'm very pleased to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
To you. I mean, we've met in real life.
Yeah.
We've done yoga together.
Yoga together, that's the ultimate of coming together, I feel.
Is it? Indeed. But Sharon was the one that had said, from Royston Youth Action, that had said when I was looking for guests, oh, you should definitely have Mark on. So Here you are.
Here I am. We'll see if that's been a good recommendation or no. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So why don't we not start this off then, just you introducing who you are and what it is that you do in the world just now.
Cool. So I am Mark Nikowski, which is pronunciation you got fine. I am currently a youth worker at Royston Youth Action, which I have been at Royston Youth Action for 6 years in January. But I was a chef for 18 years before I became a youth worker. So I was fortunate enough that I loved the career I had, and I travelled a bit. And then it was in 2012, I decided I'd had enough of cooking, because my fiancé and I spoke about possibly having a family, settling down. So all the personal stuff happening in both our lives. So I decided to leave the kitchens. But I'm the kind of cliche of, I left school with no qualifications. Like, I left school at 15, knew I wanted to be a chef, went straight to college because I didn't need qualifications for it. So I left school with literally no qualifications at all.
Yeah.
It wasn't because I wasn't clever enough. It was just because I didn't like school. I hated school. I enjoyed going to school because it was a time to socialise with my friends and get away for the house and do random stuff. So I was actually my fiance persuading me to go to college. So I went to college, got my GCSEs, and then I went on an access to higher education course. Mm-hmm. Passed that in 2014, and then went to the University of Strathclyde in 2014. And it was quite a culture shock because I was a mature student at the
Yeah.
time. Just before I started university, we found out that Monica was pregnant. So yeah, there was just a lot of different things happened at that time. So I ended up going to uni, and part of my first year, I had to do a placement, a 7-hour placement. So I chose Royston Youth Action, because I'd been volunteering at another youth organisation when I lived in Blackpool, and I loved the
Yeah.
work that Royston Youth Action did. So my 7-hour placement turned into 5.5 years, pretty much.
Yeah.
So I did my 7 hours, and then I stayed on as a volunteer, and then I was stayed on as a paid sessional worker, and this
Yeah.
led me to being involved in running an intergenerational project. And then that led me to facilitating one of your projects, the 12 months to exercise of kindness, what I'll probably talk about in more detail later.
Yeah.
And now it has led to me being a full-time youth worker. So it's crazy the way things have worked out, but it just goes to show you that anything is possible. You know, if somebody that says to me 10 years ago that I'd been a youth worker, I'd have probably laughed at them.
Yeah.
But here
If
I
they
am,
said that
and
you had gone to uni, would you have laughed at them?
aye,
Yeah.
definitely. When I left school, I'd done college. I'd done college for a year, and even though I was at Caton College, I absolutely hated it. So when I went on to do my second year, I got offered a full-time work or staying on at college, and I jumped straight into full-time work. So I thought, you know what,
Yeah.
the experience of being a chef will time me better for the future. So from that, I moved from job to job, and then I spent a bit of time in America working, and then I came back to the UK, and then I travelled around Europe a bit, and then I was involved in a tournament paintball, but I was still cooking sometimes to get extra money, and then I went back into the kitchens, and yeah, pretty much between the age of 17 until 33, I was somewhat nomadic. I just kind of went from place to place, job to job, had no fixed abode. So
Yeah.
the idea of even going back into education, never mind university, blew my mind. I've been like, no chance, that's not happening to me. But yeah, so last year I graduated because I took a year out between my third year and my fourth year, due to mental health problems I was dealing with. And then I graduated last year with a first class honours degree, which
Amazing.
again, yeah, very, very proud day for myself and my family. I think my mum and dad just couldn't believe it, that their son, who had done all these crazy things in his life, was a graduate for university. Something that they
Yeah.
never imagined. And then I had went back to do a master's last year, but I ended up leaving the course in December, just due to a number of different reasons. But the opportunity is still there at some point to go back, which
Yeah.
I do hope to do sometime. I'd love to go on and do a master's in educational studies, which is looking at the informal, non-formal ways of similar, pretty much what we're doing in youth work,
Yes.
and then look at going into the policy side of things. So yeah, that's a bit about me,
Yeah,
and a summary.
it's amazing. I think I went back to college and university in my 30s as well, and I think that at that time I was ready, because when I left school, because I was the youngest in my year, I had to stay on for 5th year and do a higher, so it was like pressure to stay there and do that.
Yeah.
And then I went to college and I picked my course based on the fact that they went on a holiday to Spain at the end of the year. So I went to
Brilliant.
study travel and tourism, and then my job, I worked in the travel industry like that for about 13 years, got to travel the world, got to go and do different stuff, and then decided that I needed a complete change of direction, and then went back to uni, and I appreciated college and uni so much more because
Definitely.
I had worked out who I was in the world and
Yeah.
what direction I wanted to take. When I was 16 leaving school, I was like, I want to do what? I was like, no idea.
It's one of those things that it's. I mean, we say it quite a bit to the young people, that there are young people that I've worked with who they know where they're going in life, they know what they want to do.
Yeah.
There's a lot that don't, and to expect a young person at the age of 14 to decide, you know, this is a career I'm going to do for the next 50 years almost in my life, I think is a bit. It's almost naive to put that much pressure on young people. You know, as I say, there's some that they know what they want to do, they know what they're going to do, and they work hard towards that goal. But then there's a lot that don't. So, I mean, I knew I wanted to be a chef, And it wasn't until I was 33 that I decided I didn't want to cook anymore. So that was 18 years of my life. I had knew what I was doing. I knew where I wanted to go. I had these plans of opening a restaurant, you know, working for myself to support my family and provide my family. But then I thought, I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And then I was in limbo because I didn't know what to do. And the thing about going back old as well, there wasn't a great deal of support. Because education is still viewed as something that is only for young people or children. Whereas when it came to me deciding, I was fortunate enough that Monica worked at the college I went to, so she could fill me in a bit more, but there's still this almost fear of going and asking questions because you are in a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something I thought about doing as well, is working with adults who were in the same position as I was, and being okay, you know, here's how you can do it, here's the support you need. I had spent 18 years writing in capital letters. Even when I was in the kitchens, I would always write in capitals. And I can remember my first day going into college and I had to write in cursive. I was lost. It was just such a small thing. And I thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go back to writing in cursive with proper apostrophes and commas and punctuation, because I had just written in capitals because it was easy. So even something as small as that, it seems quite trivial, but it did massively affect me when I went back to college. So I had to spend days getting used to writing properly again. It was mental.
It's something you wouldn't even really think about, especially if you already got a job and you're just like, this is just how I write. And once you've left school, you don't ever think. You just scroll however you scroll.
Definitely. And it was scary.
Yeah. So what then led you down into going to the, like, I know you said that you did volunteer with youth work, but what made you choose that as your subject?
So my degree itself, it was a joint honours in educational studies and creative writing, because I've always had a thing for writing. And I thought, okay, if I try and focus everything on writing, there's no guarantee that I'll get a career out of it. So that's why I chose the joint honours, so that way I could do the writing as a side thing for myself personally. But the education side, because I've always had an issue with schooling and the academic institutional sense of schooling, I wanted to go down the route of informal, non-formal, because I feel that young people can benefit greatly for both. So when I went back to college and I thought, okay, I could go in and do a primary education, or I could do my honours and then get a postgrad and teach in secondary. I thought, no, you know, the degree I get can lead me down many different ways. I can be a tutor at a college. I can work in schools in a certain capacity. I can do youth work. And when I chose my placement, I wanted to go somewhere that was almost challenging the status quo of schooling. And that's why when I was researching and I was looking into it, Royston Youth Action, based on what I've seen, what they did, how they worked with young people, you know, the way they challenged certain things in society, I thought, yeah, that's the place I want to be at. So that was the main thing, is it's kind of going against what people view as the norm. I kind of looked at getting into youth work. It was a pathway I never considered. But also, it's a challenge for me because people view youth workers as just being these men and women who maybe play pool with young people or take them on trips, or, you know, we'll take them to the cinema, we'll play games with them. Yeah, we do those things, but there's a reason we do them. And they're tools, that they're ways of getting to know young people, build a relationship through trust, and then you find issues, problems, inequalities, you know, social injustice that they're facing, then you can map a way to work with them. It's not as teaching them, it's as working with them based on what they want to know, the strengths that they've got, and how you can work on their weaknesses to make the strengths and the weaknesses equal. And that in itself is a challenge, but if you're going to go into any form of education, then you need to be challenged. You know, that's... But my dog's just sitting here, Jen. Sorry, Mala.
That's all right.
Go in, Mum. Mala.
I've had many dogs come in as a guest before.
Yeah. It's just because she's not used to me being in the afternoon. So
she's all confused.
Yeah.
So Royston Youth Action is
It's based in the East End of Glasgow, sort of East Royston's class, to sort of northeast
Northeast,
Glasgow,
aye.
yeah.
Northeast.
And Royston's probably up there with one of the most deprived areas in the city.
Yep.
The
It's ha
things in all the areas, as I live in Springburn, and I'm not aware of anything similar in the Springburn area.
There are a few. So Springburn's actually, up until I think it was last year or the year before, Springburn Community Council started providing youth services, and they've actually got a really good youth forum in Springburn. So they cover Springburn Site Hill. You've got St Paul's Youth Forum, which is up in the Black Hill area. There are a number of organisations in the East End area, and pretty much the reason being is because the is high in, and I hate using the term, but it's really the only way to get it through, is high in deprivation. That's financial deprivation, cultural deprivation, social deprivation, and it's rife throughout. And we, as I say, we as an organisation don't like using the term deprivation because it carries so many negative connotations. Where there are a lot of amazing families in the areas, and the sense of community is unbelievable. And that is something that historically has carried over, but people don't often, especially in Royston, people don't look at Royston and think, oh, you know what, it's a great sense of community, it's a great community spirit. They look at it in the past because it is, there has such a history of gang violence, violence, just troubles throughout, and when you look beyond that, there is a great sense of community, especially for the children and young people. And that's in a lot of areas as well, like I say, in Black Hill, Toll Cross, Denniston. There are a number of different organisations that are doing beautiful work out there. One of the biggest problems we face, though, is when it comes to funding and money for us, we're up against these other organisations because we're a charity-based organisation that relies heavily on funding out with government funding and government support. So if an organisation, say for instance, a big lottery announced that they've got 30 million that they want to distribute to youth services, community development organisations throughout the country, we know that when we put in an application, we're going to be competing against another organisation that is doing just as great work as we are. And unfortunately, there are some organisations that do fabricate their numbers. They do almost lie in applications, and that's morally and ethically it's wrong, but it's kind of understandable because you know that they're dependent on this money to pay for their staff so their staff can live. So as it's a constant battle between ourselves with other organisations as to who can submit the best funding application to get the money to continue the work that everybody with sees as necessary, you know what I mean? And we us in terms of the working with the young people, we work with the young people for them to almost empower themselves so that they can make a difference, their voices can be heard, they can actually have the confidence to stand and say, this is what's happening in our areas, this is how we are being treated as young people, this is how we are being demonized because of your postcodes. And we provide them, we support them on the walk, we walk the path with them for them to reach a platform and actually stand and say, this is what we need. You know what I mean? This is the only way that your areas, your communities, and your lives are going to get better as if you actually listen to us. So that's, yeah.
We saw that when the exam results first came out,
Yeah.
and it was postcode lottery,
Postcode lottery.
sorry. Yeah, and
Yeah.
that was bullshit. But then the young ones stepped up and went, "No, we're not taking this."
No.
And they got together as a community. And I was watching them because obviously I follow the Royston Youth Action page, and I saw it on the news, some of the news pages and Twitter. And I was like, "Good on them," because there's too
Yeah.
many people bitching and moaning about other stuff and not doing anything about it. They are out there getting their voice heard and making a difference. And
Definitely.
it did make a difference for
It
them,
did
which is
make a
brilliant.
difference in the end. And it kind of, I mean, I know there wasn't so much in Scotland about it, but even when you look at down in England, when you've got the head of education coming out and saying, oh, well, the reason we've given such low grades is because we didn't want underqualified people being in certain positions of power. And you think, yeah, that's ridiculous. You know what I mean? And to
They
think
went
that
to the
that's,
government.
There you go. You know, you look at the government, you look at the people that are responsible for the country and what's going on. And even up here when they were saying that, you know, we can't just take it on the basis of the teachers. So then what that's doing is that's undermining the teachers.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much saying that the people that are responsible for educating the future generation, you have got no faith in them. You have got no trust in their judgment. You've got no faith in who they believe should be getting these grades based on the work that they've submitted over the past 3 or 4 years. So then that puts the teachers in that situation where they say, well, should I really be caring? Of course they should be, because they're paid to teach, but then they've almost got a personal agenda to say, I'm going to prove to you that what we do in union and unity is what we believe is right for the young people in the country. You know what I mean? So it was a horrible situation. You had young people crying, saying, you know, I was expecting this one grade. Mm-hmm. You know, they were forecast to get a B, and then they find that they get a C, and that's everything. And again, this goes back to what I said at the beginning, is there's this expectation that young people will know at this age what they want to do for the rest of their life. So they're putting everything into it. You know, they're giving their mind, body and soul to make sure that they get these qualifications, but then they could end up going to uni for 3 years and think, this is like nearly 19 years of my life I've been in education. Mm-hmm. I need a break. I didn't want to commit as much. So it's like, not even based on my own experience. I was trying to say to young people, you know, if you know for a fact you want to go to uni, then we will support you. You know, good on you, give it all. But if you don't, you don't need to feel pressured into going there now, because there will always be opportunities for you, regardless whether you're 19, whether you're 23, whether you're 30, whether you're 40, the opportunity will always be there. You know, so don't I just put everything in, and I need to fulfill everything in these 5 years, because that's going to see where I go for the rest of my life. No, it could, and if it does, brilliant, but if it doesn't, it's not the end of the world, you know?
Yeah, and there's always other pathways to get in. Like, you went back to college and did your GCSEs and then went on and then went on, and there's always these other pathways that when you've got an idea of how you want to get there, you will find a way.
Definitely. And if you've got support, whether it's parents, friends, colleagues, youth workers, you know, coaches at sports club, if you've got that support in any way, then that will always make it easier. Because you're not just shouldering all the burden, you're not just taking on all the responsibility. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it comes down to you to study well and study hard. But it's, once you're in that, that was the hardest thing for me, was that whole pathway of getting back in, because it's no easily signposted, especially for a mature student. And for young people, it can be even harder. It's just pamphlets of jargon and stuff that they may not even be familiar with. It's just a case of maybe breaking it down in simplistic terms
Academics writing stuff to teach you how to be an academic, but forgetting that you're not an academic yet. So it's,
that's it.
Can you say this in a way that I might understand it, please?
Definitely. Just break it down. Make it simple. You know, make it in a simplistic way so it understands what you're trying to tell me that I need, or how I access it, up until I'm at a point where my vocabulary's developed, I can actually articulate what I'm processing in my head. Just make it simple. Give me an ABC if need be. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and just sort it that way. So yeah.
So you've led up a few really good projects at Royston Youth Action.
Yep.
What has been your favourite one that you've done so far?
I'd say so. As I said last year, I was kind of facilitating the 12 Months, 12 Acts of Kindness project. It wasn't me that came up with the idea. It was actually Sharon Kelly, who you know. So I'm not going to take credit for creating that. But what had happened was, I think it was 2017, some young people were helping distribute clothing to the homeless, toiletry packs, you know, small food parcels to the homeless people. And they had always seen the homeless as they were walking about the street, but because, I suppose, it's ignorance in society in general, they didn't necessarily view them as people. And when they got speaking to them, they understood that, you know, these men and women have went through horrible things in life, and this is what has led them to be where they are. You know, no one chooses to be homeless.
Yeah.
No one just wakes up one morning and thinks, you know what, I'm going to develop an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction, or I'm just going to self-destruct. there's a lot of different things that come together to gets a person to the point where they are homeless. And even when they are homeless, a lot of people that are homeless turn to alcohol and drugs because of loneliness, because of being stuck in your own head alone for 24 hours a day in the cold. The feeling you get when people are looking down on you without knowing your story.
Anything. Yeah.
That's it. So what they did is they spoke to Sharon and says, look, is there any chance we can maybe do something that's going to not only help the homeless, but help other charities throughout Glasgow? Mm-hmm. So that's when she came up with the 12 Months, 12 Acts of Kindness. That January, we'd done homeless awareness. We actually had James English, who had just filmed his Homeless at Christmas documentary. So we were the first people out with his production team that had seen it. He actually came in and viewed it in the youthy. So the young people were like, right, let's look at other charities that we can help. Let's look at other organisations that we can help. How can we help them? Whether it be fundraising, whether it be bucket collecting, whether it be doing awareness on social media. So for the January, we did work with different homeless shelters in Glasgow. The young people went down to one in the East End. I can't remember the name of it. And it was St. Anne Burns Day, So they actually put on, they'd been singing songs and doing Scottish dances and helped serve the food. And the response for the people that were there was unbelievable. You know, driving the minibus back, I don't think there was a dry eye in the minibus, because you've seen how, again, it's that little thing made such a big impact. So then that just started where we looked at different organisations and, as I say, asked how they could help. So that's been going for, it's now in its third year.
Amazing.
And I think the big thing for me is seeing that it's the young people that are leading it. They pick the charities based on whether it's their own experience, whether it's maybe a family member has dealt with something, whether it's because they feel that there's no recognition for the charities, whether there's no enough awareness. And it's empowering to see that young people are actually that socially conscious. And this is, again, for an area that is apparently high in deprivation, and young people have been labelled. And, you know, there's a whole self-fulfilling prophecy that if you come for this postcode, then you're destined to end up living a less meaningful life. Shite, pardon my language, but it's a load of rubbish. It is, because
stayed on here, no bother.
Ah, cool. and this project, I mean, in the first year, I think the Youth Forum had 8 members, and then 13. I think now we're sitting on 16 members. It's just the Youth Forum. That's the young people that lead this.
Yeah.
And provide the information to us on how they would like to help. We reach out to the organisations, and then daily is with us as well as the young people. So it is completely driven by the Youth Forum.
Yeah, and that must just fill your heart with much.
It's amazing. It truly is amazing. And it was like, even so, last year was the first year we'd done the Walk of Hope for Chrissy's House.
Yeah.
So the young people had picked Chrissy's House for whatever reason. It's, as I say, the reasons are entirely up to them. They wanted to do work for Chrissy's House. So I went out and met with Anne, who's an incredible lady. I don't know if you've ever met her, Annie Oakley.
No, I've not met her.
Even maybe see about getting Anne on to do the podcast. Yeah. Because what a lady. She's just so powerful. Didn't get me wrong. She's very direct and she's very blunt. Excuse me, but just she's such an incredible woman. So I went out and spoke to Annie. And she was kind of blown away at the fact that it was the young people. She thought it was us as an organisation that were saying, well, can we do this? Because we want to promote their organisation.
Yeah.
It's like, no, our young people want to do this. So so we ended up doing a bucket collection for them as well, and then we'd done the Walk of Hope. And we took 14 young people, and this is between the ages of 12 and 18. So myself and one of my workmates, Connor, we actually stayed over with them because we had to leave at 3 a.m. in the morning, and we knew that there was no chance that they'd be up at 3 a.m. or if they had been up at 3 a.m., it was because they had been up all night. So we ended up having a sleepover in the youthy. They made posters, they made placards, they made like beautiful artwork to take with us. And then when we got there, it was profound how powerful it was, because there was people coming up to me and saying, oh, who's a group of kids? And I was explaining to them, and they couldn't believe, and they're like, oh, they come for Royston. It's like, yeah, they come for Royston. You know, the Gangad, an area that's high in the SIMD, you know, and it's apparently fully this kind of people and these kind of people. And yeah, these kids who come for a G21 postcode have actually made a conscious effort to be here, to pay their respects to those who unfortunately are no longer with us through suicide, and to raise awareness here. And it was incredibly, incredibly powerful. And then even at the end, it was like walking around, it was weird because it was obviously the walk itself and what it symbolises was, it's pretty heavy, but at the same time, it's also some form of a celebration that those who are no longer with us because of what's happened, you know, this should still be recognised and remembered, not just because of one thing, you know what I mean? A life should never be judged just on one mistake, one act of mental fragility.
Yeah.
And to see the young people actually embrace that, it was unbelievable. Everything they do, it just amazes me. You know, we're so, so proud of the Youth Forum. The young people, what they do, not only for themselves, but for others, you know. I know our line of work, we rely heavily on volunteers. And the young people know that, so that's why they're happy to do whatever it is. We had a group of, I think it was 14, walked on Saturday in like a mini kilt walk because we were supposed to be doing the kilt walk in April for Scottish Huntington's Association. So again, one of my workmates, his father-in-law, unfortunately passed away through Huntington's disease.
Yeah.
But Huntington's disease isn't maybe the right wording, but it's not a mainstream disease. You know, it's not held up there with cancer or MS, and that's not to belittle any other, but Huntington's has taken nearly as many lives, but there's very little recognition. So even on Saturday, as I say, we had 14 young people. I think they raised £240 that walked from Royston to Huggenfield Lock, round the lock and back again. I think in total it was 6 miles.
Mm-hmm.
For a group of 14 young people between the ages of 12 and 16 to get up that early in the morning to walk for that length of time to do it in the rain and the wind, yeah, that in itself is so empowering, and they're helping to break down stigmas that's attached to young people. You know, it's even demonisation in the press. If there's a group of 30 young people in Kelvin Grove Park who are maybe enjoying the summer sun, they'll not say 30 young people were enjoying the summer sun. It'll be a group of 30 were rioting, causing mayhem. And regardless whether it's one or two, it'll be the 30 that are demonised, that's them that's labelled with it.
Yeah.
So for us to be able to say, you know what? Yeah, young people can be boisterous. Yeah, young people can be rowdy. But if you give them an opportunity to prove that they are great and there's greatness in them, then you'll be greatly, greatly overwhelmed to see how amazing they are.
Yeah.
So for me, I think some of the stuff I've done, I think personally it's a 12-month, 12 acts of kindness because of what I've seen it can do and how powerful it is. It's actually the young people that are leading it, you know. When I was kind of facilitating it, as I say, I was the bus driver, I would take them to wherever they wanted to be in order to do the amazing stuff that they do. And I don't think they get enough recognition for that. That when we tell people it's not us, we're not forcing them to do anything. They are in complete control of the power and what they want to do and how they want to do it. And they choose to do it. You know, they want to actually do it and they want to help and make a difference. And it's not just for the young people that do it at Royston Youth Action. It's to try and break down these stigmas and tear down the social inequality that young people throughout Scotland face, especially in the West Coast.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and them being able to do that, and, you know, you had said at the start that you're a big advocate for supporting mental health. Doing all this kindness stuff then helps support their mental health, so it's making them more robust.
Definitely.
So, as they get older, they'll have these skills that they can, that they'll be able to fall back on. And even if they do have mental health issues, there's that resilience has already been, sort of the foundations have been laid, definitely.
Yeah, totally.
So, would you want to talk a little bit about your mental health journey? And
yeah, no problem. So I I suppose for me, I've always had insecurities, but I'm also looking to, I was always old school in the sense that a man shouldn't open up, you know, you need to be resilient and you need to be tough. And then when I got kind of older in life, I thought, you know what, no man is an island. Everybody needs support. Everybody needs help. So first thing that I kind of understood that I was struggling with mental health was in 2008.
Yeah.
And I turned a lot to, I was never alcohol dependent, but I enjoyed drinking because it kind of took my mind away from what I was dealing with. And because I was a chef, it was almost seen as the norm to go every night and party and get drunk and go to parties and live up to this kind of lifestyle, this expectancy that being a chef used to bring with it. And then I had a point one evening where I was actually sitting at the window ledge of a fifth story floor with a bottle of vodka, thinking, you know what, I can't keep going like this. And then I managed to pull myself back in, went to sleep, woke up the next morning and thought, right, I need to do something here. So I actually went, I packed a bag with everything that I could sell, all my possessions that could get me money, DVDs, videos, clothes, trainers, everything. And I went and sold them to different places. And I got about 160 quid for them all. I never got much. I sold them at a cheaper price than I should have. Mm-hmm. And I stood at a Waverley train station and I thought, right, I can do one of two things. I can either jump in a train and go down to my mum and dad's because they live in Blackpool.
Yeah.
Kind of not get help and support because I didn't believe I needed counselling, but I just needed that, like, some kind of assurance, some form of solidity in my life because I had been nomadic for so many years. Or I could just go to a pub and spend on this and get absolutely blazing drunk and then I'll be even in a worse situation tomorrow. So thankfully I jumped on a train, I went to Blackpool. I'd been working in London before that, I'd been kind of coming and going. And then I went and I lived with my mum and dad's for a while, just to try and sort my head out a bit. That was when I met my wonderful better half. And then I kind of go back to a better place where I was feeling more confident. I was feeling more reassured in what I was doing. And then I was kind of fine. But it was actually 3 years ago. It was coming towards the end of my third year at uni. And I'd been doing incredibly well, better than I ever imagined I could. And I had professors and doctors that were coming up and presenting me with opportunities. You know, if you do this, we could look at this. You can go in and do a master's. I'd love to have you as a PhD student. You know, I was doing really well, but a lot of that was doing to my own work rate because I was committed to doing the best that I could. And that meant spending a lot of time away from my family. It meant a lot of evenings and mornings spent in the university working on assignments and reading and researching and going over and above. So at the end of my third year, I got offered the chance to do a internship. It was a paid internship with two professors, and it was to do a research paper with them, which would have been, at the end of it, it would have been published, so I would have had my name attached to an academic journal.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And things didn't kind of go as I had planned, because I felt, and this wasn't just me, this was after I'd spoken to other professors, I felt that because I'd kind of done so well and I went in with so much credibility that they left me to my own devices. Mm-hmm. And I'd researched for assignments, I'd never researched for an academic paper. So there was loads of wee things that I just built up and built up and built up, all these added pressures I'd kind of put on myself. And then I felt myself falling, and then I fractured my ankle and my heel, and this added to problems. And as I say, it was just a lot of silly wee things. They're not silly, but I viewed them as being silly.
Yeah.
And then Monica and Connor went to Poland for a couple of weeks during the summer, and I was here on my own. And the feeling of overwhelmed was just too much, and I kept falling further and further and further into a hole. And then it was one night, I was sitting on the couch, and I just started crying, bursting into tears uncontrollably.
Yeah.
And I had never felt anything like it, and then I was having thoughts like, am I depressed? What have I got to be depressed about? You know, I'm comfortable with my family, I'm doing well at uni, I've got a job, I'm working in a job I love, with people I love, and working with amazing young people, and you know, why am I being so upset about this opportunity, this internship? And it was because I put so much pressure on myself.
Yeah.
And then again, there's this feeling of oh, I shouldn't have put so much pressure on myself. Just carry through, get through it. You know, you'll have an academic paper released and then you can use that to follow up and go on. And it to me, it seemed like such a culmination of so many silly, trivial things. But ultimately, it did lead to me, unfortunately, being clinically depressed. So I actually, Monica phoned me one evening and she was like, look, what's up? I was like, I don't know. I've never felt this way. I've never felt it. It's no stress. You know, I'd spent 18 years working in kitchens. I knew what stress felt like. But I never felt anything like this in terms of mentally or what I could do or how I could get over it. So I was due to go back and do my fourth year. And I went and spoke to like the student support. Told her I was leaving uni, told her how I was feeling. And she says to me, she says, look, you're suffering badly with depression here. And she says, really badly. She says, to a point where I need to get you to go and see a counsellor. And I was like, no, I can't be depressed. What have I got to be depressed about? You know, there's folk that are worse off for me. And she's like, yeah, I get that. That you know, that, and that's something that people do challenge, is that there is somebody worse off than you. But at the same time, it's your mind, it's your problems, it's your issues. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how small or insignificant it is, it's your personal thing. And with the mind being such a complex thing, you never fully know how to handle or deal with something. You think you do. I thought I'd seen everything in life, and I thought I had experienced everything in life, and I'd handled it until this happened, and I realised, you know what, I'm no as secure in my own mindset as I thought I was. So it was difficult to kind of accept. And then I'm thinking, you know what, I'm a failure because I shouldn't be this way. And there's people that are a lot worse off than I am and dealing with far greater things than I am. So I'm failing at life. I'm failing not only people that have kind of put this pressure on me academically, like professors and doctors. I'm failing them. I'm failing myself. I'm failing my family. I'm failing my friends. I'm failing young people I'm working with because I'm there trying to tell them, you know what, you can overcome anything, but really I'm failing at everything. And it was grim. So I did go and see a counsellor, which I found to be somewhat condescending. So I decided not to go back. Yeah, I had a few sessions with her, but I found that, I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy it at all. I found it incredibly, incredibly condescending. So I spoke to Sharon, told her what I was going through, told her that I had kind of been diagnosed. Excuse me. She was brilliant. She's a big advocate of if staff need help in terms of mindfulness or well-being or mental health. As with young people, children, families, she will try her best to reach out to people who can offer help and support. So I spoke to Sharon, decided to, rather than leave uni, I took a year off. So I was working more hours and I was kind of feeling better. And then in 2018, it was actually the 5th of June. I was still having good days and bad days and good moments and terrible moments, but I was in a serious funk, like properly. I'd been working, I came home, had my dinner, just wasn't right. And I said to Monica and Connor, I says, look, I'm going out for a drive. And I went out and I had no intention of actually coming back. I'd planned to go and take my own life. So I'd left here and I drove and I stopped off at a service station in Cumbernauld and I got a £3 Tesco meal deal. So it was a sandwich, a bottle of juice and a packet of crisps because I just felt really hungry.
Yeah.
And I drove to Callander and I sat at Loch Lumnig for a while until it was getting darker. I just sat in the car listening to music. I'd sent a message to Connor, Monica, and I'd sent a message to my parents and I switched my phone off. And then I drove. So there's a place near Aberfoyle called the Three Lock Drive.
Yeah.
And it's gated. So after 5 p.m, there's actually a gate that gets closed over and you need a code to go in. So I drove up. I had the code because we sometimes go up and we used to camp there. I put the code in and I drove. and I drove to a spot where I thought nobody will find me. And I'd actually planned to drive my car into the lock. And then I thought, even then, if I have a realisation that I'm doing something wrong with the weight of the water getting into the car, I'm going to be able to get out. And then so I ate the sandwich, I drank the juice and I ate the crisps. And then out of nowhere, this random guy, when I say random, he's the most random looking guy I've ever met in my life. He looked a bit like Zach Galifianakis, you know, the actor in The Hangover with the curly hair and the glasses and the beard. It resembled him greatly. So anyway, chaps on the window, and he had a pair of grey sweatpants on. He had an old like 1990s Rangers t-shirt and a kind of red zip-up hoodie. And he's like, "You all right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm cool." And he's like, "What are you up here for?" I says, "Oh, I'm camping." And he's like, "Mon, I'll give you a hand to pitch your tent." And I'm like, "No, it's all right, mate." And he's like, "Oh, I'll give you a hand." And he started speaking to me, and he spoke to me. He spoke to me. I didn't actually speak to him. He spoke to me for about 3 hours, just sitting. And I used to smoke, but I stopped. And he was like, "Do you want a cigarette?" And I'm like, "Yeah, cool." And I smoked a couple of cigarettes with him, and he just spoke to me about the most random stuff. And then he's like, "Oh, is that the time? I better get back out of my tent." He's like, "You know, better off getting home to your family." And I was kind of like, "Yeah, you know what, maybe I should." So I jumped in the car and I drove back down the road. And it's like, normally it's like maybe a 50 minute to an hour car journey, and it felt like it took minutes. I can't even remember driving back. And then when I came off at Rob Royston, and I stopped in Black Hill, and I just sat, and I felt numb. I felt numb, void of all senses. I just didn't know. I didn't know what I'd done. I knew what I'd done. I knew what I'd planned on doing. But it was one of those moments where it was like, how could I have done this to my family? How could I have done this to the people I love, the people that care for me, the people that I know will support me through anything, will always be there? Even when I feel like I'm the most horrible person in the world, they will still support me. And I ended up coming back to the flat, and when I pulled up, there was a police car outside, and I just started crying. I just sat in the car and started crying. And then I came up, and when I came in, there was two policemen sitting. Monica had already contacted the police as a missing person. And then the police asked me to go into the bedroom to speak to them, and I went in, and again, I just broke out crying. Just couldn't you know, and it's kind of, I look back at it and see, because I do some writing, I'm kind of in the process of writing a story called "A Packet of Crisp, Bottle of Juice and a £3 Sandwich," because if it wasn't for that £3 meal deal, I honestly don't know if I'd be here speaking to you now. And with that in mind, it's kind of made me realise how vulnerable we are as humans, no matter what anybody's dealing with, no matter what anybody's going with. No matter how big a problem is or how trivial a problem is, it can affect people in so many different ways, and how vulnerable we are to the kind of self-destruction that we're capable of. So it's not exactly the most cheerful story, but it has got a happy ending, in the sense that I'm still here.
You're still here, and there's probably lots of people that have been through something similar, or there's been more thoughts in their mind than they would ever care to admit.
Definitely.
And because I know this is Suicide Awareness Month, September. So as people, we need to break the taboo of it. I mean, I know my cousin, my second cousin, took his own life. One of the girls that I worked with in Greece took her own life, and then three other people who are yoga teachers. You go, "Oh, yoga teachers, you're all calm and serene." Well, I know three that have chosen to take their own path, and you're like, wow, you never know what's happening.
This is it. I mean, no matter how mentally strong you think someone is, it's like, unfortunately, one of my best friends, his cousin took his own life, and he had everything going for him, you know, had a fantastic job, beautiful home, beautiful family. know somebody that you would think of, what's going on? And then he unfortunately was at a point where he couldn't handle it. He went and he took his own life. And this is what I say to everybody. It's like, don't judge anybody based on how they're acting. And it's, you know, the people don't even need to be down or showing signs. You know, it can be the complete opposite. You can, somebody you think might have changed in their demeanor and their personality and their character, and you think, oh, they're on their way out, they're doing well. Mm-hmm. Maybe the realization that they're actually comfortable in the fact that they're going to be dying soon. They are happy, they are jovial, not because they've turned their life around, because they think, you know what, I'm comfortable at the fact that in a week I'm going to kill myself. So again, it's all the signs and all the wee things that you need to be aware of. But even when all that was done, I still couldn't come to terms with, I almost felt, you know, I was like selfish. Because some of my friends have endured horrific things. One of my best friends, unfortunately, his partner passed away. He's left with two young daughters. Another friend of mine, she unfortunately, her child passed away as well. And I was actually speaking to my friend. And I was like, you know, I feel bad because given what I'm dealing with and kind of how it's came to me and what you're going through and your family's going through, I says, I almost feel selfish, you know, because mine's is something that I kind of, not brought on myself, but I did have, at one point, have some control over. Mm-hmm. And her exact words to me was like, you know, your shit is your shit. And that's what matters. You can't look at what anybody else is kind of going through and go, you know, they're worse off than me, because they might be dealing with the larger problem easier than I am, or someone else is dealing with what might seem as a smaller trivial problem, because it's based on your mind. And that's something that I live by. Even when I'm speaking to young people, it's like, whatever you're dealing with, whatever you're fighting, whatever you're battling is yours, it's personal to you, and you need to ensure that you give yourself as much time, effort, attention, as care as you would your friend or your colleague who you feel is fighting something bigger. You know, it's and in that sense you should be selfish, because if you don't do something in order to help you, no fix. I don't like when people say, oh, we need to fix you, because it's not something that needs fixed, that needs realigned or it needs reworked. Mm-hmm. Or we need to look at a way to even kind of slightly reprogram, but no fix, because no one will ever be truly fixed. It's not a broken bone, it's not a cut, you can't just stitch it up. So this is what I try and get through to the young people, is I love the fact that you want to try and help other people and you want to be there to support, but what about you? Who helps you when you need it? And who will help you when you need it? You know what I mean? Yeah. So as much as we are in this, everyone's in this battle to ensure that suicide prevention is out there, people are aware that suicide can happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. We still need to be somewhat selfish and focus on ourselves, you know what I mean? And our own self-love, and ensure that we know that we are worthwhile being on this planet, you know? And that's the one thing that I think a lot of people forget, is you do need to love yourself. And if you can start unconditionally loving yourself and helping yourself, and then you can help others. Until you know where you are or kind of understand what works for you, then you can't truly help or support other people. And that in itself takes a lot of time and a lot of pain and some suffering, but it is worthwhile. It is worth it in the end.
And a lot of trying different things, because what works for you when you're a teenager might not work in your 20s, might not work in your 30s, might not work in your 40s. So it's looking for different ways and always changing, and not comparing yourself to other people.
Yeah.
Whether it's they're positive or they're negative, you can't compare yourself to other people. And I remember, I think it was Brené Brown said that if everybody put their problems into the centre of the room and you got to choose anyone, you would take all your own problems back.
Yeah.
You'd be like, no, it's right, you can keep that one.
<That's> it. Definitely. And it's, again, especially working with young people, is there is more awareness out there in terms of, you know, mental health and mental health support and awareness and mindfulness. I mean, even mindfulness, I love the mindfulness and I love what mindfulness can do. But even in schools, like I've engaged conversations with other youth workers and people in the education system, and even mindfulness in schools now is becoming somewhat neoliberal, because teachers aren't saying to young people, you know, mindfulness is beneficial to you to discover who you are and what you're about, where you want to go, and it can help you. They're saying, well, if you don't practice mindfulness, you can't pass an exam properly, or you'll not learn as you need to. So a lot of young people are being turned away from mindfulness because they still see it as, if I don't practice mindfulness or self-awareness or self-love, I'm not going to pass an exam or a test, so I need to do it rather than wanting to do it to understand why. So I love that schools are introducing mindfulness and mindfulness sessions, and they're giving them areas where they can go and reflect and do many different things, but it's still this whole idea of institutionalization through schooling, you know? And this is something that it annoys me, it really does, because mindfulness in itself is an incredibly powerful tool, but mindfulness should also be something that you choose to do because you feel like you can, and you know enough about it, and you know what you're trying to discover is ultimately you and your place and where you can go. Not just because a teacher's saying, well, if you didn't go to a mindfulness session, you'll not pass your exams. You know, again, it's adding pressure to them that they don't need to have it.
And just it's another thing to do.
Aye. That's it. It's crazy.
Has mindfulness been one of your main tools since your attempt?
I'd say so, yeah. I look at self-reflection a lot and mindfulness just through try to kind of reconnect, so to speak, to who I am. Again, because it's something that I had never really truly experienced. You know, I had moments where I was down, and even in my point in 2008, but I kind of knew that there was a fix. My fix was my personal life, my personal situation. Yeah. Not so much where I was, but it was the fact I didn't really have anywhere to go. I felt like I was just in a moment. I knew what I needed to do to get better, and I did. For the last, the past three, nearly 4 years, I know that it's there's not one thing that can help me or fix me or make me better. That comes down to me, and that comes down to how much I'm willing to put in order to reach a point where I can kind of go, you know what, I'm not over it, but I am a lot better, and I feel more empowered as a person to go on and do more. I'm still having that battle. I still have my days where I think, you know what, I can't handle this. But then I look at the kind of the aftermath of what happened when I didn't go through with it.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine what would be left if I did. So I'm very aware of that. I'm very conscious that I'm still here. I will have horrendous days.
Yeah.
But I then need to be thankful for the really good days. You know, even like the wee thing, like when we took your son to school for his first day, it was reflecting on that. I thought, I wouldn't have been here. You know, I don't even know if my son would have been going to this school. Maybe Monica and Connor would have moved to Poland. Mm. Maybe they'd have moved somewhere completely different. I don't know. So it's reflecting in terms of the mindfulness. It is kind of looking at alternatives. You know, what can I do for myself? You know, who am I almost, and where am I? I'm in a different position in my life than I was 5-6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that in 5-6 years, I'm in a different position to what I am now. So yeah. This is where I'm finding like mindfulness and looking at different pathways and alternatives to try and help myself. In December, I did look to get medication, and I was actually prescribed sertraline. And in the end, I didn't take them because I'm a big believer that I want to be in control of my own thoughts. I want to be in control of my own mind, and I want to be in control of my own feelings. And no matter how dark
you just frozen there.
Or is... Hello?
Oh, hold on a wee second. Right, you've just frozen. Right, I think you're back now.
Back.
Right, that cool. Just... Hold on, am I recording? Hold on, I thought I pressed pause on record there, but I don't know that I did. Recording. There's always a wee technical glitch somewhere. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be anything if it wasn't technical difficulties?
Yeah, so you kind of froze there when you were saying that you wanted to be in charge of the thoughts, whether they were dark thoughts or not.
Yeah, it was just because I felt that if I'd have taken medication, then it's almost blanketing things. And then when it got to the point where I would maybe come off of medication, I don't know how it would be. And I don't know how I would get through that period. So in the end, I decided not to. And that was when I looked at doing a lot of different things to try and help. There's days where it's terrible. But at least I know that I have got some control. You know what I mean? It may not be much, but I'm still functioning as best I can. And that's what I can do. I'm functioning with it. Being numbed without my thoughts being conceived by a tablet that numbs the senses and mm-hmm. You know, I thought, no, you know what, they're still sitting in the kitchen and they will remain there. So yeah, it's just different, finding different ways to get through it.
Yeah. And do you speak about this to the kids and the youth groups?
Yeah, I am open. No, to the point where I told them what happened in terms of me going away, but I am open. But because one of the big things that you often hear as well, you don't know how it is, you don't know how it feels. You know what I mean? If I maybe read something and I'm speaking to something about a statistic or, you know, a process or an outlook, you'll hear, I've heard it often, like, well, you don't know, you're just regurgitating something you've read. So I've actually got lived experience, you know, I live it every day.
Yeah.
And I'm not telling you that what works for me will work for you. Because again, everybody's different. Everybody's mind is different. Could be doing something completely different from what I do or approaching a different method. It could be running, it could be reading, it could be writing. You know, Right to Recovery is great as well. But at least if they know that I can empathise with them on a personal level,
yeah,
you find you get a better response. And that's not just me, that's something that the majority of the team at Royce Youth Action are open, no too open, you know what I mean? Because you still need that professional personal balance. Mm-hmm. But in terms of mental health, I'm quite open. And I find that the response you get is better. Because you're not just telling them what they want to hear, you're kind of telling them what they need to hear to know that, yeah, you know what, I'm living it. And I won't trivialise what you're going through. I won't judge when you speak to me. You know, it could be anything. Like, oh man, I snapped my shoelace this morning, and it's like my favourite pair of shoelaces, and it's like, cool, let's work our way around that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't trivialise, you can't judge, you need to take everything and respect everything that a young person tells you. And then it's a case of making them aware that, you know what, you're not going through this alone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We will work with you in any way that we can. Even if it's like, you know what, I think yoga would help. Cool, let's see if we can organise a yoga session. You know, I want to punch something and get my frustrations out. Right, let's see. Excuse me. See if we can get a punching bag. You know what I mean? You need to work with them in any way that you can. And that was kind of how sorry, on you go, Jen.
No, I was just going to say, quite often when somebody snaps about something like a shoelace breaking, it's never about that incident that just happened. It's about the build-up of everything else that's going on in the background.
Yeah, and that's the spark, that's the catalyst for everything else. And that was kind of how the boys' health group came about, because there was an increase in... awareness in males' mental health, you know, try to get rid of toxic masculinity, get men to open up. In order to get men to fully open up, you need to start at the grassroots, which a lot of mental health starts in teenage years. It's not until they get older that they realise, you know what, I'm battling something here, and then at which point it's maybe too late. So with the boys' health group, we don't focus solely on mental health. We look at everything, you know, whether it be career prospects, alternative pathways, physical health, mental health, but it's also trying to break down the kind of toxic masculinity that comes with living in the west coast of Scotland, especially an area that is regarded as one of the tougher parts of Glasgow.
Yeah.
You know, if you look back at the history of Glasgow, it's like the No Mean City thing, you know, Taggart situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's making them realise that what worked two generations ago isn't necessarily going to work now. I'm not expecting you to openly cry in front of me, but I would like you to think that if you do want to cry, it's perfectly normal, you know, and it's something that small. And that's why we kind of thought, okay, we do the girls' health group and the boys' health group. And even like male body shaming, you know, it's more apparent that women are social media. Social media is an incredibly powerful tool, but at the same time, it's terrible. And girls, women do tend to be judged more than men. However, it does happen with men. You know, young guys maybe follow somebody on Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok, and it's like, if you've not got a six pack and muscles, then you can't be considered a man. No, everybody's going to have six pack and big muscles. A lot of guys will go to any means necessary, whether that be starving themselves, whether that be filling themselves full of these meal shakes, whether it's taking weight loss tablets, which is pretty much an amphetamine, try and it does happen, unfortunately. So again, it's getting through to them, you know, be comfortable in who you are, be proud of who you are. We can all work harder to have a better body. I mean, I'm the Adonis, you know what I mean? And I'm under false intentions that I am perfect, but at the same time I'm comfortable in who I am. I know I could be better, but I'm comfortable. I'm still active, still play sports, I still do a lot of things, even though I am regarded as an obese guy. So it's just discovering that you can be comfortable. You don't need the muscles, you don't need a six pack, you don't need a chiseled jawline, you know, you don't need a perfect haircut.
Yeah.
You can be happy with who you are as long as you embrace who you are and you're proud of who you are. So,
absolutely.
And all this again ties in with the mental health, you know, positive mental health. If you can love even one thing, I'd done a session with some of the guys, and it was, you know, what do you love most about yourself? And it's like, I don't love anything about myself. It's like, you must love something, you know. Oh, it doesn't need to be a physical asset, it can be anything. And it's like, oh, I love the fact that I'm good at drawing. Well, there we go, man, you know, be a great drawer. And a few of the guys are like, oh, man, I love my legs, I love my shoulders. It's like, that's cool, love them, but don't you think that defines you as a person? There's more to you than just an aesthetic.
Yeah. And then it's the same for the guys that are on these magazine covers and are in social media. Most of them, like the women do, put filters on it or Photoshop it, or they only look like that for the photograph, and then afterwards they've got a wee bit of a puffy tummy, or it's the lighting, or it's the way they've done their fake tan or whatever. And it's that we have to educate men about what we've been getting educated about as women for a long time. It's like, now this is now crossing over to men, so you guys need to be aware of this, because we've been dealing with it for years and it still hasn't changed.
No, totally. And then again, it's also it's like the whole social media thing as well, where, you know, people are having millions and millions of followers, and the outreach that some of these people have got is ridiculous, you know, and they could be doing some powerful stuff, but because of sponsorships or money they get, they're not allowed to. They couldn't post a picture of them with, like, this is me after eating a cheeseburger, look, I've got a gut, or this is me sitting drinking a 2-litre bottle of Iron Brew. They need to be pristine because they're being sponsored. They could go, you know what, yeah, the sponsorship's great, it's bringing me a lot of money, but I want to be a bit more real, I want to get across. So it's making them aware as well that, exactly as you say, what you see on social media isn't always real. You know what I mean? It is filtered, it is touched up, it is edited, it's the lighting, it's the toners, it's abundance of ways to kind of make yourself look better. And yeah, hopefully the work that we're kind of doing is educating them and making them see that, yeah, everybody's got flaws. Everybody's got insecurities. But you can still be a beautiful person, and you can make a massive difference in the world and do amazing things.
Yeah.
I think ultimately it's what we try and get through them. You know?
Yeah. When you've got that beauty coming from within and it's in your personality, then everything else about you just shines.
Right. Like, well, definitely. And it's you're being true to yourself, but you're also being true to others. And I think if you are, again, come back to this whole, if you're truly comfortable with yourself, then you can radiate so much more. And, you know, you can make people realise that, you know, you're a beautiful person, you're a beautiful human being. You can do amazing things. And I think it's something that we kind of lose track of. We just hopefully we can educate a new generation. And this is like with the young people that I work with, as I tell them always, it's people always say, oh, they're the next generation. They're the current generation.
Yeah.
It's this group of young people, not just the ones that we have the pleasure of working with, but all across, they're the ones who are going to be educating the next generation. You know, so it's none of this, or yous are the next generation, or yous are the current generation, yous are the now, yous are the ones that are going to hopefully break even more barriers and break more stigmas and smash walls down for the next generation, so that they're kind of more educated and more aware and recognise social injustice and social inequality, and they can start making a stamp on it now rather than waiting. So that's another big thing that we're kind of pride ourselves on is that awareness.
That and they're creating that ripple effect within their peers, like, so people that don't have the opportunity to come and have actual contact with you, they've got contact with them within their own communities out with the youth club, when they're in school, when they're in the town, when they're just in life dealing with other people, they're setting that example, and other people are always watching, like, they're always watching what people are doing and leading from that example.
No, definitely. And then it comes down to like the peer mentoring thing as well, taking the younger ones and showing them, even learning for previous ones' mistakes, and it's just, hopefully, as you say, it ripples on, it passes on, and it can continue to go and go and go. And as long as, like, I know Royce Youth Action and other organisations are still there, then we'll continue to promote and, you know, shout with great pride loudly as we can about the amazing stuff that young people are capable of, and what they've still, you know, the potential they've still got to reach, and how they can get out there and make a massive, massive difference. Already are, but they just need to get that wee bit more recognition.
Be
amazing.
I know. So where's the best place for people to check out what Royston Youth Action's up to?
Social media. We are big on our social media. We're always posting, you know, even if it's just a wee inspirational morning quote, just to make people know that, you know, they're not alone, we're always here. So your social media platforms are Facebook. Which is, if you just bear with me, so our Facebook, Royston Youth Action, is just Royston Youth Action. Instagram is RYA Youth Project. And Twitter, I'm on Twitter, but I don't know how to use it, so I'm not that big on Twitter. Like Sharon's like Twitter queen.
I think the Twitter one is the RYA Youth Club. Well. I think that's what it is, because I follow you and all of them.
We also have a website. Which is royston youth action.co.uk. So you find out that's updated regularly also with everything we're doing, different clubs, I also add as well, like Royce Youth Action doesn't just work with young people. Your age group is from primary one right up until 25. Yep. So we do amazing work with children as well. Your children work team are phenomenal. Again, a lot of activities in terms of games and having fun, but they always try and incorporate some social factors in as well. So yeah, working with children up until primary seven, and then for first year until, well, legally in Scotland, a young person is from 12 to 25, right up. So we don't just work with young people, we work with children. We do a lot of work in the community as well. We a lot of the older ones. We are looking at starting another intergenerational project as well, again, but it depends on funding, you know what I mean? That's our biggest factor is funding. So if there's any millionaires listening that want to like throw a couple of million quid their way, even a couple of hundred thousand, or even a thousand, just anything, because we do rely heavily on our funders and fundraising as well. Just say the children do beautiful work with the primary ones to primary seven, and it's not just about giving them a place to go after school. It's about trying to get them involved in social activism, I suppose, make them aware of what they can do and how they can do it, and the children are involved in the 12 months 12 acts kindness project as well. So it's just that continuation of getting children, and then they become amazing young people who then can go into the world as fantastic adults and radicalize the negativities in the world. That's the ultimate plan and goal.
Amazing. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
No, really. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Sorry if I kind of rabbit owner, but keep trying to make a difference in the world. If anybody's listening and they feel that they're incapable of doing something, it's a load of rubbish. Everybody's capable of amazing things. You just need to kind of discover what you can do, and just keep fighting a good fight, you know. Don't judge, support people, be kind. Kindness matters. And let's try and make the world, or at least our world, the world we live in daily, a better place for everybody. And that's pretty much about it.
Amazing. One last wee thing before I say thank you and let you go. The guy who came and spoke to you for 3 hours.
He
do you have any idea who he was?
Thank you so much. if you do, so I never even like Zach Galifianakis, and you've got what's that, sorry? You froze there a bit, Jen.
If it looks like Zach. What's the name, Zach Killer?
Zach Galifianakis for The Hangover.
Zach Galifianakis.
And then we happened to have a really haggard 1990s Rangers strip, a pair of grey sweatpants, and you were at the Three Lock Trail in Aberfoyle on the 5th of June 2018. Then you get in touch. It'd be cool to maybe catch up with you and have a proper conversation. And I'd like to say thank you as well. You're a truly remarkable human being.
You're the angel showing you compassion and kindness. Definitely. And he may not have had any idea.
No.
It might just have been one of those gut instinct things of, I need to go and talk to this person.
Yeah. But that's it. We've all got the capacity to do that. Even just saying thank you to somebody or how are you? You know, good morning.
Yeah.
Kindness is an incredibly powerful tool.
Yeah.
And it can make such a massive difference. Yeah. Let's try and
be
stop
kind.
Making people feel that if they've got kindness is a wonderful thing. Just stop judging people and stop what they're going through. Don't judge. If somebody comes to you to speak to you, then they're coming to you because they trust you. It's because they want to. And sometimes they need to. So just listen without judgment.
Awesome.
Thank you so
thank
very
you
much,
so much,
Jim.
Thank you.
My pleasure. I hope. I hope people listen. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
We will.
Cool. Well, thank you so much again, pal.
So, what did you think of that? Such a powerful story. I am so grateful for Mark for opening up and sharing his experience. And that guy that came and had that 3-hour conversation with him, he must have known something was up. He must have known in his gut that he just needed to be there and to do something. So if you are familiar with the description of that man and you have any idea who he could be, then please reach out to him and tell him the wonderful thing that he did without even knowing that he did it. And Mark commented at the end about medication and how he had got a prescription for it and chose not to take it. For some people, medication is a lifesaver, but you have to decide for yourself. You need to think, what is the best way for you to deal with it? And it may be taking the medication, it may be not taking the medication, it may be going down another path. But if you're in a dark place, or even if the place hasn't got dark yet, but the light is starting to dim, reach out and speak to somebody. There are so many of us out here with ears willing to help where we can, to just be an ear to listen to. So please, please, please do not suffer in silence. Reach out and speak to somebody.
Thanks for listening, and remember to leave a review and subscribe over on iTunes or SoundCloud. And check out what's going on at iamjenwilson.com, or head over to Instagram and give us a follow, just following iam.jenwilson.